All right, so the background of this, the events of 1 and 2 Samuel took place between the years of 1105 BC, the birth of Samuel, to 971 BC, which is the last words of David in 2 Samuel 23. Thus, the book spans about 135 years of history. During those years, Israel was transformed from a loosely knit group of tribes under the judges to a united nation under the reign of a centralized monarch. They look primarily at Samuel, which was 1105 to 1030 BC, Saul, who reigned from 1052 to 1011, and David, who was king of the united monarchy from 1011 to 971. So throughout this, I've dug heavily into commentaries by Dr. J. Vernon McGee and David Gusick, and then notes from Pastor Steve for this study, and they're all kind of intermixed as we go through this. The book of 2 Samuel continues the message that we had in 1 Samuel. It is given over entirely to the reign of David. The life and times of David are important because he is the ancestor of Jesus. It shows that the governments of this world in the hands of man is failure. And I think we're seeing that clearer and clearer and clearer nowadays. You know, that man controlling us is not going to be the answer. And that's one of the big lessons in this. So the first 10 chapters really cover the triumphs of David. The book of 2 Samuel continues the message of 1 Samuel. So it's the triumphs of David. The beginning, David is mourning the death of Saul and Jonathan. So if we jump into chapter 1, 2 Samuel, the question of who killed Saul may not be answered in this chapter, but it adds another suspect. A young Amalekite escaping out of the camp of Israel reports to David the death of Saul in verse 8. So let's read verses 1 through 4 of 2 Samuel. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. So it was when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, "Where have you come from?" So he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." Then David said to him, "How did the matter go? Please tell me." And he answered, "The people have fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also." So right in that first opening, after the death of Saul, King Saul and his three sons were killed in the battle against the Philistines, dying on the slopes of Mount Gilboa. It was the sad ending of a tragic life, concluding the story of a man who came to the throne humble, but left it hardened, bitter against both God and man. An Amalekite claimed to have killed Saul. Ironically, Saul lost his kingdom for failing to annihilate the Amalekites. If we do take the Amalekite story as true, this is a chilling statement. In a unique war of judgment, God commanded Saul to completely destroy the people of Amalek. Saul failed to do this, and an Amalekite brought a bitter end to his tragic life. I'm going to jump back to 1 Samuel 15, 2 through 3, if you want to turn, but either way, I'll read it real quick here. "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have, and do not spare them, but kill both man, woman, infant, and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Annihilate them. The lesson for us in that is that we need to utterly destroy that which will destroy us. You know, I'll jump back in my life when I was getting clean from my life of drugs and alcohol. I had a sponsor, and he talked to me, and he knew I was struggling with this process, and he said, getting clean is easy. All you got to do is change one thing, just one single thing, and you'll have no problems. And I said, okay, I'll bite. What's the one thing? And he said, everything. You got to change your job. You got to change every single friend you have. You got to change where you live. You've got to decide that you're going to give it all up, or you will never move forward. That's the truest statement of our life with Christ. If we don't give up us, if we don't give up self, how is he going to get a foothold? So that was a lesson that has stuck with me day after day, that if you're going to change, you got to actually do it. You can't just sit back and say, I want it. You got to do it. Though the Bible doesn't specifically say it, Amalek is commonly regarded as an illustration of our fleshly carnal nature. In Deuteronomy 25, 17 through 18, basically states, like our fleshly nature, Amalek focuses its attack on the tired and weak. In Exodus 17, 11, we have, like our fleshly nature, the battle against Amalek is only won in the context of prayer and seeking God. Those changes that we need to make. So verse 9 and 10 in the first chapter, the Amalek claims credit for killing Saul. Verses 11 through 16, the Amalekite is put to death. And 17 through 27 is David's lament. Verses 17 through 19 is the Song of the Bow. This is David's grief over the death of Saul and Jonathan. And it's touching. It's poetic. It's dramatic. It's a striking lamentation. This is David's funeral song for Saul and Jonathan. And you think about David doing this as a funeral song for Saul and Jonathan. It's interesting that the one who mourned for Saul, David, was the one Saul was trying to kill. Proverbs 24, 17 through 18 says, do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and it displease him, and he turn away his wrath from him. David gave us a pretty good example there of how we should treat those that treat us harshly. Take that lesson and just put it in your pocket. In verses 25 through 27, we understand how important it is for the mighty to stand. Verse 25 in verse 1 says, how the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan was slain on your high places. Verse 27 says, how the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. If we look to 1 Corinthians 10, 12, it says, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. So what are we supposed to stand for? The darkness of this world surrounds us. We see this darkness growing daily, and we are called as Christians to stand for Christ. What does it mean to you to stand for Christ? What does that look like today? Anybody? This is where you jump in.
Stand up against the war in Israel. Stand up for Israel and support all those who believe in Jesus. Mm-hmm. And just carry on the fight.
Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else?
Love.
Yeah. We're called to love.
Right.
The world. We're called to love our enemies. We're called to love in so many ways. You know, that's one way where we get to show that we're standing up for Christ.
Israel's doing that right now by sending flyers, letting them know what they're doing. Yeah. That's an act of love. There's no reason that they have to do that. But they're doing that because they love life.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things that, you know, that I look at it as we go through life. What are we, you know, the times that you may not want to speak because you're embarrassed or you don't may not want to admit whatever it is in your life that's going on, you know, that's how we stand up for Christ. It's an honesty that we've got to have, you know, and I think David shows us that through this chapter, you know, being honest with God. And that's something that we need to look at. So let's go to chapter 2. Because we can't get stuck on chapter 1 for 50 minutes. David made king over Judah. Abner, the captain of Saul, made Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, king over the remaining 11 tribe. Civil war ensues. David defeats Abner and the army. So let's look at the beginning of that, chapter 2, verse 1. It happened after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to any of the cities in Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." David said, "Where shall I go?" And he said, "To Hebron." Verse 1 states that David inquired of the Lord. Certainly this was a key to David's success in life. With rare exceptions, he consistently inquired of the Lord. David wanted more than God's blessing on his own plans. He wanted to be right in the middle of God's plans. So now we're going to jump to chapter 3. We got to jump fast. So chapter 3 is a long civil war weakens the nation, but David gradually gains in strength. David makes Hebron his home at this time. Abner, after his falling out with Ish-bosheth, deserts to David. Joab, David's captain, suspects him and seeks revenge for his brother Ashel's death. Murders Abner. Abner had brought Michal to David, David's wife, previously as a condition of making peace with David. The thing that's important to recognize here is when we try to make peace between King Jesus and King Self, the result is a long, bitter war. Yeah. It's so much better to simply surrender and submit to the reign of Jesus. Alan Redpath stated, "In the lives of many Christian people today, there is a raging, literally, a civil war. The flesh, the kingdom of Saul, struggles with the spirit, the kingdom of David. And the conflict is bitter. We do everything we possibly can to hold up the tottering kingdom of self so that it might exist just a little bit longer. If we only could preserve some rights, if we only could have at least part of our own way, if only we would keep this or that at any cost. We feel we must bolster up this kingdom of self that we cannot let ourselves be crucified with Christ." 2 Samuel 3:17-18. "Now Abner had communicated with the elders of Israel, saying, 'In time past, you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then, do it. Now then, do it. Because of the word of the Lord spoke of David, and because it was right to do so, this was something that should be done now.'" In this sense, it's very much like our commitment to follow Jesus. We should be told, "Now then, do it." Charles Spurgeon, and I went into the weeds on this one. Charles Spurgeon has an incredible sermon on those four words. "Now then, do it." In this sermon, he shows how the same principles of Israel's embrace of David as king apply to our relationship with Jesus? He says the Israelites might talk about making David king, but that it would not crown him. They might meet together and say they wished it were so, but that would not do it. It might be generally admitted that he ought to be a monarch, and it might even be earnestly hoped that one day he would be so, but that would not do it. Something more decided must be done. The sooner it's done, the better. Until the deed is done, remember, you are undone. Till Christ is accepted by you as king, till sin is hated and Jesus is trusted, you are under another king. Whatever you may think of it, the devil is your master. Spurgeon wrote of those of us that refuse Christ in this sermon. He said, if you do not see, it is because you have laid your fingers heavily upon your eyelids to keep out the light. If you have not heard, it is because you have stopped your ears till they have become dull of hearing. The knock at your door by your Lord's pierced hands has been kept up for year after year after year, almost insistently. And even in the night watches, you have been startled with it. God calls us, and we get the choice. Do we get to turn our lives over to him? That's our choice. So I'm going to just jump right through chapter 4 with Ish-bosheth is murdered as he lay on his bed by his own leaders, and then David executes the murderers. So that's the short burst on chapter 4. You can dig into it more. And that's something Joe mentioned as we were talking, I think, earlier this week. What we do here, all of the teachers, we're giving you such a fast run through this. Our hope is that you go home and dig into this. And as you find these things, this is a great opportunity for us to grow even more so together by taking that time to either go through the chapters before on a Saturday, so you know where we're going and what we're missing, or to go through afterwards and get that in-depth study. It's one of the benefits. This has been so exciting when I get to jump into this, because it's such an in-depth study as we're going through such a large block. But there's no way we can cover everything in that. So we pick and choose. It's your chance to go back through this after a lesson and really dig into the areas that stood out to you. So I challenge you to do that. So chapter 5, after much bloodletting, David is finally made king over all Israel and moves his capital to Jerusalem. Note the approach of the 11 tribes to David as we go through this. David takes Jerusalem from the Jebusites. Hiram, king of Tyre, furnishes men and materials to build David a palace in Jerusalem. Let's look at 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 1 through 5. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and spoke, saying, indeed, we are your bone and your flesh. Also, in time past, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Lord said to you, you shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel. Therefore, the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord. And they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months. And in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. Verses 1 through 3 there, we see that all of Israel comes to David. You shall shepherd my people Israel. David previously was the shepherd of his father's sheep. Now he's the shepherd of God's people. Psalm 78, 70 through 71 says, he also chose David his servant and took him from the sheepfolds, from following the ewes that had young. He brought him. to shepherd Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. The son of David. Who's that? Jesus Christ is the true shepherd of God's people. Referred to as the good shepherd, the great shepherd, and chief shepherd. It was David who wrote in Psalm 23:1, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." All right, so verses 5 through 10, Jerusalem is taken for the capital of Israel. Verses 11 through 16 in this, we see that David builds his house. 17 through 24, the Philistines attack David. I want to look at a couple verses in this, verses 9 and 23. And it's important to know that David inquired of the Lord both times before he fought the Philistines. In verse 19, we read, "So David inquired of the Lord, saying, 'Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hand?' And the Lord said to David, 'Go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into your hands.'" We look at verse 23 through 24. "Therefore David inquired of the Lord, and he said, 'You shall not go up. Circle around behind them and come up from them, upon them in front of the mulberry trees. And it shall be when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry trees, then you shall advance quickly. For then the Lord will go out before you and strike the camp of the Philistines." So the Lord directed David each time in a different way. He didn't just say, "Go." He directed him very specifically in a different way. I think it's important that we recognize this pattern. David each time searched for God's will. David was already seen as a great leader. He could have come up with a plan on his own, and the people would have followed. No question about it. How often do we each go through life's decisions with our own understanding and not seeking God's will for our life? We don't want to give up our own will. I know there have been times in my past that I chose not to seek God's will, not to seek God's direction, simply because I just knew he wouldn't want me to do what I wanted to do. Anybody else? I didn't want to let go. Seek God first, as David gave us an example of. Flip forward to Matthew 6:33. Anybody know the verse? Wally, you got to know it.
I should know it.
Yeah, okay. That's okay. I'll tell you what, I'll read it. "But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you." So what are the things? Let's expand this and go to... That's why I want you to look at this. Look at
peace, love, and charity.
Well, in verses 30 through 34, it says, "Now if God so clothes the grasses of the field, which today is and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you? Oh, you of little faith. Therefore, do not worry, saying, 'What shall we eat? What shall we drink? What shall we wear?' For all these things the Gentiles seek. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble." So if we just seek God's will, God will provide for us in every way. So in chapter 6, David does a good thing, or does a right thing in the wrong way. He tries to bring the ark up on a cart.
Right.
Although God had given implicit directions for moving it. The tribe of Levi were to carry the ark on their shoulders, which we read in Numbers 3 through 7. Uzzah was smitten dead because he should have known better than to touch it, as the ark was about to fall. Hands off was made abundantly clear in God's instructions concerning it. David then brings up the ark in the right way in verse 13, Michal, David's wife, rebukes David for his enthusiasm and devotion to God in bringing up the ark. So 3 through 10 gives the story of God and Uzzah being striked for touching the ark. David fears and leaves the ark with Obed-Edom. Close. Uzzah's error was more than just a reflex action or instinct. God struck Uzzah because his action was based on a critical error in thinking. Uzzah erred in thinking it didn't matter who carried the ark. He erred in thinking it didn't matter how the ark was carried. He erred in thinking he knew all about the ark because it was in his father's house for so long. He erred in thinking that God couldn't take care of the ark himself. He erred in thinking that the ground of Nashon's threshing floor was less holy than his own hand. McLaren wrote, he saw no difference between the ark and any other valuable article. His intention to help was right enough, but there was a profound insensibility to the awful sacredness of the ark, on which even the Levitical bearers were forbidden to lay hands on it. 2 Samuel 6, 8 through 9, if we head back there, David reacts with fear and anger. In verse 8, and David became angry because of the Lord's outbreak against Uzzah, and he called the name of the place Perez Uzzah to this day. David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? David became angry because of the Lord's outbreak. Uzzah dying. David's anger was based in confusion. He didn't understand why his good intentions weren't good enough. God cares about both our intentions and our actions. We can't just think that we should do good things. We have to actually do them. We have to live the life. We have to step out of just thinking about it or showing up on Sunday and looking like it. We've got to make that move past that. So David asks again, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? David knew it was important to bring the ark of the Lord into the center of Israel's life. He wanted all Israel to be excited about the presence and the glory of God. Because of what happened to Uzzah, David felt he couldn't do what God wanted him to do. David's response in the rest of the chapter, and we don't have time to dig into that, shows that he found the answer to this question. We read in Proverbs 9:10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. You know, David's life is such a good example in many ways of seeking God. You know, we're going to learn that Wally covers some of the errors of David in the next few chapters, but one thing David always did was tried to be in the middle of the Lord's will. We must have a healthy balance as Christians between the sacrificial love and the holiness of God. We can't put God into our own box. We can't make God just what we want. God is only love. God is only this. God is only retribution. We can't pick that. We've got to make sure that we have a healthy understanding of who God is. And God is just. God gives us grace. God is holy. And we need to come to him with that understanding, that we're not just going to our buddy. We're going to a holy God, the King of the universe. In 2 Samuel 6, 11 through 15, David brings the ark up the right way. 1 Chronicle 1 through 4, Chronicles 26, 1 through 4, indicate that the family of Obed-Edom belonged to the Levitical family and could safely care for the ark. So the ark is brought up. 1 Chronicles 15:13 through 15 says, "Because you did not do it the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us, because we did not consult him about the proper order. So the priests and the Levites sanctified themselves to bring up the ark of the Lord of Israel. And the children of the Levites bore the ark of God on their shoulders by its poles, as Moses had commanded, according to the word of the Lord." So it took two times, and they finally did it right. In 2 Samuel 6, verses 16, and then also in 20 through 23, Michal despises David for his devotion to the Lord. His wife looks at her husband and despises him for his devotion to God. We read in verse 16, "Now as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and whirling before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart." What a statement. She despised him in her heart. David's wife, Michal, didn't appreciate David's exuberant worship. She felt it wasn't dignified for the king of Israel to express emotion before God. In verses 20 through 23, David returned to bless his household. And Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself today in the eyes of the maids of his servants, as one of the base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." So David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me instead of your father and all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord, over Israel. Therefore, I will play music before the Lord, and I will be even more undignified than this, and I will be humble in my own sight. But as for the maidservant whom you have spoken, by them I will be held in honor." Therefore, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. It was before the Lord. David didn't let Michal's sarcastic criticism ruin the day. He simply explained the truth. "I did it for God, not for you." Another great example, you know, David, king of Israel, is out just praising God with no regard for who's watching or what they think, because he was excited about God. He was excited about what God was doing and honoring God by bringing the ark in. So there was nothing that was going to hold that back. So if we jump to chapter 7, God's covenant with David makes this one of the greatest chapters in the Bible. The message of the Bible from this point rests upon the promise God here makes to David. David desires deeply to build the temple to house the ark of God. And Nathan, the prophet, concurs with him in the plan. God appears to Nathan to correct him, for God will not let David build the temple because he is a bloody man, a man of war. God gives him credit, God gives him credit for his desire and promises to turn to build David a house. God promises a king and a kingdom to come in the line of David. Verses 1 through 3, David desires to build a house for God, and let's read. "Now it came to pass when the king was dwelling in his house, and the Lord had given him rest from all his enemies around, that the king said to Nathan the prophet, 'See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells inside tent curtains.' Then Nathan said to the king, 'Go do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you.'" At verse 3, "do all that is in your heart," you know, coming from the prophet. Important to keep that one in mind. God, in verses 4 through 6, we read, God instructs Nathan to tell David that he will build him a house, but it happened that night that the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, "Go and tell my servant David, thus saith the Lord, would you build a house for me to dwell in? For I have not dwelled in a house since the time that I brought the children of Israel up from Egypt, even to this day, but have moved about in a tent and a tabernacle." And it continues there. Clearly what we have is Nathan spoke too soon. There's an important lesson. Christians rightly make most decisions based on a general understanding of God's will and a desire to honor him. You know, I think all of us in this room, we base our decisions and our walk on what our understanding of God is, what our understanding of what life as a Christian should be. And we desire to honor him. But we must always be ready to listen to a corrective word from God. There's a saying that when God closes a door, he opens a window. Don't know how, you know, theology fits into that, but nevertheless, it's a saying. But too often, we as Christians keep banging on that door that we want to go through. We keep banging on it because we know that's where we have to go. We've got to, that's our choice, that's our path, that's our decision. And so we keep banging on that door and ignore the window that God's provided. We need to understand that God doesn't always fit into our plans. Sometimes when God responds to us, it's a yes, go. That's where I want you. Other times it's a simple nope. That's not what I want for your life. And the hardest one for me is when God says wait. You know, I'm pretty good with the yes or no. The wait, not so much. So in verses 10 through 11, covers that Israel will be secure and David's house or dynasty will be built. House is used in two very different ways in this chapter. David is referring to a temple. God is referring to a dynasty. Verses 12 through 17, the covenant that God made with David. This is one of the most important sections in the Bible. 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 13 says, "When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom, and he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." In 2 Samuel 7, 16, we read, "And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. The throne shall be established forever." Through these passages, we see God's referring to both Solomon, the earthly temple, and a fuller future fulfillment in Jesus. That's a chapter that's worth going back and studying extensively. So I'll leave that one with you. Verses 18 through 29, David rejoices before the Lord on this. So if we jump to chapter 8, David consolidates his kingdom. He gains victories over the old enemies of Israel, covered in verse 12, and enlarges his kingdom in verse 15. He brings the surrounding nations under his control. He brings in the Philistines, Moabites, Syrians, and Edomites. We read in verse 15, "So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered judgment and justice to all his people." This was a time where David was very much the king of the land. You know, very clearly with bringing all the surrounding nations under his control. Chapter 9, we're going to kind of jump right through. David befriends Mishabeth, the son of Jonathan, whose feet were lame. David brings him into his palace and gives him a place at his palace table. This is covered in verses 7, 10, and 13. And this really reveals the kindness of David, that he's reaching out, and it's just a good example of that. Chapter 10. In this chapter, David defeats both the Ammonites and the Syrians to avenge the insult to his messengers sent to Hanun, king of Ammon. Verses 1 through 2 is where David sends his servants to Ammon. The Ammonites take them for spies and humiliate them. Verse 4, if we read in chapter 10 there, therefore Hanun took David's servants, shaved off half of their beards, cut off their garments in the middle at their buttocks, and sent them away. Hanun took David's servants, shaved off half of their beards, and cut their garments in the middle, and sent them away. To us, not that big. At that time, this was a disgraceful insult to these ambassadors from Israel. In that culture, many men would rather die than have their beard shaved off. This was because a clean-shaven face was the mark of a slave, and a free man wore beards. With the value universally set upon the beard by the Hebrews and the other Oriental nations as being man's greatest ornament, the cutting off of one half of it was the greatest insult that could have been offered to the ambassadors, and through them to David, their king. This was an act of war, a declaration of war. And David, after this, prepares for war. The Ammonites here hire the Syrians, bolstering up the numbers. And David's men deal a great blow to the Syrians and the Ammonites, killing over 40,000 men. Wow. So huge battle. And the armies of the Lord won. That covers chapter 10. So, conclusion. As we're reaching the end here, I think the best summary for chapters 1 through 10 in my heart and what God spoke to me as I went through this isn't found in chapters 1 through 10. It's back to Matthew 6:33. Following David's heart. Following what we've seen through this chapter, the conclusion for this is, but seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. That's what I want to leave you with today. So as Gene so eloquently puts it, that's all I got. So any questions for Bill?
Now, what did you just say?
The notes in front of you.
David had a lot of wives and concubines. He had a big family.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Part of his problem.
That was part of his problem, but it was also the way he secured his family.
Yeah.
Was through alliances.
Different world.
Yeah.
You know,
God was accepting of that.
Yeah. And we've learned over time that one wife is enough.
We understand.
It's plenty, and it's all we need.
Yeah. No, my question really relates to, why did Bathsheba cause such a big issue if he had so many other...
Well, Wally's going to be covering that next week. Wally gets to cover that. Anybody else?
Because I found one enough.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, okay. Any comments you have on that, Steve?
Great.
That was.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
This was a joy to go through, you know, and I wish timing limits so much what we can cover, and that's why I say it's so important to go back, you know, that chapter 7 in this. To go into the commentaries, I spent a day digging through that and got 5 minutes of talking out of it. There's so much depth. There's so many resources. There's so much in some of these chapters that there's just no way we can cover in a short time today. So I challenge you, go back, dig into chapter 7. It's too important not to.